questions. Wasting an opportunity to learn seems pretty dumb to me. It's difficult, though, to let go of the idea that people may view you as stupid. At the end of the day, we all care to some extent what other people think, except maybe Kanye West. He might not care what anyone thinks. But what's more important, doing a good job or saving face? When I was on the set of my first ever feature film, Dr. Cabby, I became great friends with Kunal Nair, a.k.a. Raj from The Big Bang Theory. Yes, he talks to girls in real life. Every time he would act a scene out, I was mesmerized by how invested he was in his character. If his character was sad, Kunal felt the pain and it showed on screen. I also noticed that after a scene, Kunal didn't always feel the need to watch playback. I was obsessed with checking playback because I wanted to make sure I looked okay in the scene. When I asked him about it, he dropped a knowledge bomb that would help me in several areas of my life. He said, "People get too concerned about looking stupid on screen, and so they constantly check the playback. You can't be scared of looking stupid. Instead, just be how your character is supposed to feel." I think that's a great rule to live by when it comes to looking stupid. Doing a good job should be more important than how you look. With that lesson in mind, I created a rule for myself. If you don't understand something, ask questions until you do understand it. And I mean really understand it. If that takes 2 or 3 questions, then so be it. That's not looking dumb. That's being dedicated to learning something new. I know now that a highlight is something that goes on your cheekbone with powder, not a Sharpie. People have stopped looking at me weird. I think it's essential for growth to occasionally surround yourself with people who are smarter than you. A big reason I moved from Toronto to LA was because when it came to YouTube, I was the most knowledgeable person in my hometown. Before I moved, people would approach me and ask, "You make money off YouTube?" And I would have to explain that ads run on my videos. So yes, I did. When I moved to LA, people were suddenly asking me questions about my watch time, pre-roll ads, and how I window my content. I was like a deer in headlights because I had no idea. All these people were smarter than me when it came to YouTube, and it forced me to become better. During my Streamy Award acceptance speech, I said something very important that I would like to repeat here. As I stood in front of a room full of fellow creators, I said, "People always say that if you're the smartest person in the room, then you're in the wrong room. Looking around, I can definitely say that I'm absolutely in the correct room because you're all so talented and inspirational. At the end of the day, you can't learn new things if you're always the one giving the lessons. You need to be around people who challenge you, intimidate you, and teach you new things. Being a boss isn't always about being the best. It's about placing yourself in the best situations. If I ever feel like I know more about legalities than my lawyer, then I know my lawyer is no longer right for the job. If I ever start managing myself better than my actual manager, then there's a problem. If I'm always in rooms that are overly comfortable, then I'm in the wrong rooms. The only way you can become smarter is by giving yourself a chance to be dumb sometimes. So go forth and be dumb, but just don't hurt yourself. Don't play with stray dogs, and if you touch something hot, drop it. Thanks for the tip, Snoop.
Chapter 33, You Are an Investment. And this chapter is about Lindsay Sterling, so Lindsay, take it away.
I have a friend named Lindsay Sterling who just happens to be, in my opinion, one of the most talented people on the planet. Lindsay is a musician who freezes time with her violin, or at least that's what it feels like. She has millions of views on her YouTube videos, and when I say millions, I'm not talking 1 or 2. One of her videos has 156 million views. One video! The first time I ever saw Lindsay perform was at one of her concerts in Los Angeles with 4,000 other audience members. Lindsay is an extraordinary performer who dances, leaps across the stage, and nails quick costume changes, all while keeping her toes pointed and playing the violin flawlessly. Basically, what I'm trying to say is that Lindsay is amazing and super successful. That's why I was utterly shocked to hear that she still takes violin lessons and, pause for dramatic effect, practices every day. every single day. When Lindsay told me about her lessons, I thought, okay, I feel like your teacher is just making free money because, hello, you're Lindsay Sterling. I'm pretty sure that if I Google the word violin player, a picture of Lindsay will show up. In fact, let me try it right now. BRB. Okay, back. I was right. Her picture came up, no joke. Why on earth is she taking lessons? Lindsay explained to me that there's still so much she feels she can learn when it comes to her craft. Every day, she practices little finger movements that allow her to play a little smoother. She demonstrated one of the movements to me, and I watched in amusement as she held an imaginary violin and moved her pinky exactly 1 centimeter from left to right. What I learned from Lindsay that day, and what I continue to learn on my journey to become a boss, is that you are never too good to stop investing in yourself. We live in a constantly evolving environment, so we need to evolve and grow. Your best today may not be enough next year, so keep developing. Here are a few ways that you can invest in yourself using time, energy, and money. Number one, time. When I graduated from university and got my degree, I remember thinking that I would never be a student again. Little did I know that I would continue being a student for the rest of my life, because learning never stops. After all, the best teachers in the world are the ones who are still students. Learning new things means taking the time to read books, watch YouTube videos, hello, self-plug, and attend events that will expand your current knowledge base. For example, when my social campaign Girl Love started to get serious momentum, I began taking time out of my day to research women's issues. Through various articles, Emma Watson's speeches, bless her soul, and books, I taught myself new things about gender inequality that I'd previously known nothing about. Investing this time helped shape the future of Girl Love and made me a better advocate for women's rights. Number two, energy. Due to ATP and carbohydrates, everything I'm talking about will, scientifically speaking, require energy. But honestly, don't be that person and correct me. Investing energy into yourself refers to taking classes, like Lindsay, practicing your craft, like Lindsay, and ensuring that you're making decisions that will benefit you. I don't stalk her, but this is probably like Lindsay too. These things require not only time, but focus and repetition, and therefore energy. For example, if you're a vocalist, take singing classes, practice in the shower, and choose not to smoke cigarettes. You're never too good at anything that you can stop putting energy into getting better. Some of the top actors in the industry still have acting coaches, choreographers still take dance classes, and The Rock still has a personal trainer. He could probably personally lift a train, but he still chooses to work with a trainer. Which leads me to my next point. Number three, money. When I first started gaining momentum in the entertainment industry, I was hesitant about bringing a manager on board. I was confident that I could handle everything that was being thrown my way, and I didn't need to pay someone. It wasn't until my inbox became flooded with thousands of unread emails and I began missing booking opportunities that I decided it was time to hire a manager. Over the next years, my career has grown at a rapid pace, and I'm constantly adding people to my team. With every new hire, whether it's a lawyer, assistant, or editor, I'm hesitant because, well, no one works for free. I didn't want to keep adding to the list of people that I would have to pay. My outgoing payments were starting to add up, and as a business owner and person of Indian descent, I found myself really concerned. Over time, though, I noticed that the more money I spent, the more money I made. Investing in a team has allowed me to produce more content, make more brand deals, and create more revenue streams. Additionally, investing in a team has given me more time and more opportunities and has generally helped my business grow. The best example of money well invested is my PR team, probably one of my biggest expenses each month. I was hesitant to spend the money on PR because I thought, I am my own PR company. I have 9 million subscribers. But again, you're never too good to be better. Since hiring my publicist, I've gotten on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, and have been featured in countless magazines. None of this happened overnight, and I did not make back the money I invested immediately, but the results were worth the money and the wait. Another way to invest money in yourself is by supporting your own projects. This book is a great example of that. When the conversation started about how to announce this book to my audience, I wanted the idea to be epic. I didn't want to simply tell my audience at the end of one of my videos that I was writing a book, nor did I want to post an Instagram pic with the big news. I wanted to do something above and beyond. And as with most things, above and beyond meant spending money. As part of my publishing deal, there was no budget for any type of special announcement, so whatever I decided to do would have to come out of my own pocket. I knew my goal was to create a very special announcement and get the word out, so I invested a decent amount of money into creating a visually stunning short film promoting my book. It was expensive and physically and mentally taxing, but time, energy, and money were the investments required to make it happen. A few weeks later, I announced my book on The Tonight Show, Hello Return on Investment PR Team, and the next day I uploaded my above and beyond announcement video. As I write this, I haven't reaped any direct benefits from this investment. I will likely never make back the AdSense revenue, the ads playing on the video, what I spent on that video, and that's okay. I made the video to help establish myself as an author by getting more eyes on my book, and I'm hoping to reap the benefits in the long run. You are revolutionary. You have amazing ideas. You have the ability to create, to change, to solve, and to influence. Don't sell yourself short by not spending your time, energy, and money on creating the best version of yourself. Instead of buying the new iPhone, which will be slightly bigger, slightly faster, slightly more waterproof, and 10 times more expensive, use that money to bet on yourself. Instead of scrolling mindlessly through Facebook and checking in on what everyone else is doing, use that time to check in on what's happening in your life. I would tell you to also spend your energy on yourself, but your body uses ATP and carbohydrates to create energy that is used for everything you do. So, reading this very book is causing you to expend your energy. Ha! Gotcha, sucker! No, but for real, invest in yourself. Okay, this chapter comes with a homework assignment. So, pull out a piece of paper and make yourself an outline for making an investment in yourself. Outline one investment in each currency that will help you reach your goals. One for time, one for energy, and one for money.
Chapter 34, F Protocol. Early on, we learned that it pays to follow the rules. When I was in elementary school, I got good grades for coloring inside the lines in art class and praise for running basketball drills within the pylons in gym class. Even as an adult, I'm expected to drive my car inside a narrow lane on a narrow road while stuck in traffic, surrounded by open land. After going through security at an airport, there's a yellow line I can't cross until the customs officer says so. Once I noticed an officer was free and so I stepped ahead on my own, he stopped me, sent me back to the line, waited all of 2 seconds, and then called me forward. Ah, good old protocol. In my opinion, some protocol is necessary for the world to function efficiently. Rules and systems need to be in place so that people don't run completely wild. Imagine a world without laws, single-file lines, or etiquette. Sounds like the buffet line at an Indian wedding reception, and just thinking about that is stressing me out. So what I'll say is this. Rules are important most of the time. But there are other times when you should F protocol. Think about it. If everyone followed protocol all the time, no one would ever do something for the first time. Nothing would change. No one would stand out or stand up to injustice. Take Malala Yousafzai, for example. Malala grew up in Pakistan, where women are denied the right to a high school education. That's the rule. But at a very young age, Malala took a stand, and she's been fighting for female education ever since, despite daily threats to her life. By challenging the system, Malala changed not only her own life, but the lives of countless young girls who have been forced to end their education before ever reaching high school. In 2014, Malala was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. She was 17 years old. I'm inspired by Malala's courage every day. I think there are so many lessons to be learned from her story. And while there's no way I can compare any example from my life to the brave actions of a hero like Malala, I recognize that on the most basic level, she broke the rules, and there's so much value in that. Giving protocol a big middle finger, or, well, you know, average-sized in my case, I'm not Godzilla, has proven to be fruitful in my life more than once. Here's just one example. As you may know, The Rock is my hero. Always has been. When I was in fourth grade, I jumped for joy when I found out Dwayne Johnson would be doing a signing in my city. On the day of, as soon as the bell rang after school, I ran to my uncle's car and we raced to the mall where the event was being held. Once we parked, I speed walked to the door, daydreaming about all the great conversation I was about to have with The Rock. Maybe he would take a liking to me and adopt me. Ugh, my parents would understand. I mean, it's The Rock.
if he wants a child, he should get a child. I saw a huge line of people and I knew I was headed in the right direction. I glanced at the front of the line in the hopes of catching a glimpse of the star wrestler. And I did! Except it wasn't The Rock, it was Mankind. Another wrestler, not all of humanity. What was happening? In extreme panic, I asked a security guard where The Rock was, and he said that at the last minute, WWF, this was before it was the WWE, hashtag always remember, had sent Mankind instead of my future father. I was crushed. That marked the beginning of my lifelong quest to meet the man who inspired me for most of my upbringing. From that day forward, I flew to wrestling events around the world whenever I could, trying to meet him. There was always something standing in my way, though. Security measures, makes sense, my ticket not being VIP enough, or simply lacking the funds to purchase a meet and greet. I tweeted him again and again, mentioning in my videos, constantly repeating that meeting him was the number one thing on my bucket list. Fast forward to many years later, and through a series of fortunate events, God somehow blessed me enough to receive an email in my inbox from Dwayne. Through my work on YouTube, we've become friends, and I vividly remember having a mild panic attack when he actually gave me his number. For a year, I would text him every once in a while, still having no clue what it would feel like to meet him in person. You've already heard the story of my experience meeting Dwayne, and so I'll keep this brief. Having said that, I would like to highlight a specific part of the story for the sake of this chapter. In the entertainment industry, protocol is the law, or at least that's what I've been taught. No matter how minor an event is, you schedule it and send a calendar invite. Need to borrow a pen from my desk? Well, how's 4:03 p.m. today for that pen pickup? Great, I'll send an invite. On a red carpet, you dress to meet a certain unspoken dress code, no matter how impossible and uncomfortable it is to walk in those shoes. And talent doesn't speak to other talent to set meetings. Your people speak to their people. When it came to The Rock, I followed protocol. As a result, even though I'd become text buddies with Dwayne, I still wasn't any closer to meeting him in person. I got my manager to email everyone and their mothers, and still nothing happened. I tried going through my agency to set up a meeting, but every time the result was just a lot of empty promises. I kept trying to navigate the system to check off the number one thing on my bucket list. It never worked. The night before the MTV Movie Awards, an event I knew Dwayne and I would both be attending, I emailed my entire team for the millionth time, practically begging them to make a meeting happen. I knew I would be in the audience and he would be backstage and I would not have the credentials to get into his area. After sending the email, I paused for a second. Then I said, you know what? F this. This system is stupid and I'm going to do this my way. I pulled out my phone and directly texted Dwayne, asking him if I could meet him the next day. Now, this may not seem like a big deal, and you might be thinking, obviously, why wouldn't you text him? But in the entertainment industry, everyone will convince you that's inappropriate and wrong. In my head, I was breaking all the etiquette rules. I took a risk because I wasn't going to let Mankind ruin my chance again. This time I'm talking about humanity, not the wrestler. The result? The next day, not only did Dwayne kiss me on the cheek, but he recorded the entire thing on his phone because he'd been looking forward to meeting me too. He made sure I got the credentials I needed to access the green room he was in, and it was the most magical moment of my life. Hey, protocol, F you, you jabroni. Since this meeting, there have been countless other times in my career that I've made a request or suggested something outside of the box, and the response has been, well, that's not how things are traditionally done. Well, here's the thing. A boss doesn't need to always do things the way they're traditionally done. A boss does things however they need to be done, by any means necessary. I have made a career out of making videos on the internet that involve me dressing up like my parents and drawing a beard on my face. So don't tell me about all the traditional protocols I need to follow. Sometimes I also get told about how my business should be operating and how involved I should be. I've been told that it's not appropriate or necessary for me to be looped in on email threads regarding my own business, because that's protocol. If protocol means I can't see every email that involves decisions being made about me, then protocol can go directly to jail without passing go and receiving $200. I don't care about the system people are used to. I care about the system that works for my business. Whatever you do in life, there will be protocols and rules. The majority of the time, you should probably follow them. But every once in a while, if you feel like a rule is not accommodating to the magic you could create, draw outside of the lines, knock over the pylons, and cross the yellow line. Break the rules and get things done. Sometimes it'll result in something magnificent, and sometimes it might result in complete chaos. But sometimes it's better to ask for forgiveness than to ask for permission. So break boundaries and go beyond the limits set in place. Don't let a system and the people who exist in it tell you how you should act if it doesn't feel right to you. Do things your way. Break the system. How's 4:11 p.m. for that system breakage? I'll send an iCal invite. What? Some rules just make sense. Chapter 35. Be Santa. Oh, I didn't see you there, Baus, said no one ever. Of course you notice a Baus. They walk with purpose, speak with confidence, and light up a room, so it's impossible to miss them. In The Exorcism of Emily Rose, you thought she turned her head all the way around because she was possessed? Pfft, wrong. She just saw a Baus enter a room. One of the most identifiable qualities of a Baus is their energy. Something about them stands out and leaves a lasting impression on people. They're not easily overlooked or forgotten. I learned the power of having presence when I had my first meeting with my current multi-channel network, aka MCN, Studio 71. For your information, an MCN is essentially like a record label, but for YouTube content. My meeting was with the head of the company, Michael, and I knew I had to make a great first impression. We did the, hi, how are you, nice to meet you bit, and then he asked me, so, what can I tell you about the company? Now, as much as I wanted to make a great impression and get signed to this company, I also knew my own value, and I wanted to make sure the company was right for me. I wanted to be with a company that would work hard for me and vice versa. So with a smile on my face and a little bit of sass on my tongue, I replied, you tell me. What can you tell me about the company? I'll never forget the look on everyone's face when I uttered those words. He looked at me with amusement, and I could tell I'd totally thrown him off guard. Like a Baus. After a few minutes of him pitching the company to me, you know, due to my curveball, he finally asked, what do you want to achieve? To this, I responded with complete honesty. I said, world domination, with a straight face. After a beat, you know, for dramatic effect, I began to elaborate on everything I wanted to accomplish. There was so much presence in the room that the past and future started feeling insecure. The meeting finished, we shook hands, and I went on with my day. Shortly after, the head of the digital department emailed me to tell me that Michael had said, she's an absolute star. Let's make sure we get it right. Turns out that Michael was impressed by our meeting and gave his blessing to sign me. Later that week, I signed with Studio 71, and we've had a great relationship ever since. I work hard for them, and they work hard for me. First impressions are important, but they aren't the only times you'll need to demonstrate your Baus presence. Here are some guidelines on how to not only make a great first impression, but also impress people beyond that first encounter. Number 1. Smile for a reason. We've been trained to smile on demand when we meet someone new. It's a polite and expected thing to do. However, a Baus doesn't just smile because they're supposed to. That wouldn't be genuine. To have true presence, smile for a reason. Smile when you hear someone's name. Smile when they tell you what they do. And smile when they tell you how they know your friend. I'm not suggesting that you stare at them blankly when you first meet them, but don't show off your pearly whites right away. Smile in response to meeting someone new based on something they do or say, not just because it's the conventional thing to do. And give yourself bonus points if you smile while repeating someone's name after you meet them. This gesture acknowledges that you are happy to have met this specific person and aren't just going through the motions. Number 2. Listen to understand. We often listen to people talk so that we can respond to what they're saying, and not because we want to understand what they're saying. Instead of thinking of a response when someone is speaking, pause and focus on what they are actually telling you. Really think about it. Then engage and ask questions to further understand and continue the conversation. Being present means showing interest in what people have to say. I learned the importance of showing interest from my friend Bridget Mendler. The first time I met her was during my trip to Kenya in 2016, and I quickly noticed how engaged she was with other people. When I told her about my recent musical project, she didn't change the topic to her projects or music, despite the fact that she's a singer herself. Instead, she listened to me talk about my song and then asked me questions about it. So, do you plan to release an album? Where can I find it? How much music do you have out? When I replied, she would think about what I said and then continued to engage me on a deeper level. I left our conversation feeling super special and remembering every detail about what we talked about. Being a good listener and a great conversationalist is key to having true presence. 3. Don't be robotic. Just as you've been trained to smile when meeting someone new, you've also been programmed to speak a certain way. When someone asks, how are you? You will likely say, good, how are you? But are you really good? Is that truly an accurate reflection of how you're feeling? If you want to have great presence, mean what you say. You'll make much more of an impression if you say, you know what? I'm actually pretty good. I woke up feeling a bit under the weather, but this party has cured me. What about you? It sounds more interesting, and it may even spark conversation. Maybe even tell this person how many times you threw up this morning because you were hungover. Or, you know, maybe not. Number 4, live in the moment. The best way to have presence is to be present. Mind blown. This means that when you're at an event or talking to someone, be there entirely. Don't constantly check your phone or be thinking about something else. Instead, take in your surroundings, meet new people, be interested in what's going on, and absorb the energy of the room. Not only will you probably have a better time, but you'll appear more approachable. No one wants to approach someone who's scrolling through Instagram stalking their ex. Here's a tip. Before you enter a room, commit to being present by saying a simple sentence like, for the next 60 minutes, I am entirely here and nowhere else. Number 5, be confident. It's no secret that a big part of having great presence is being confident. Confidence is one of those things that's easy to talk about, but sometimes difficult to have. Don't worry, I got you. Here are a few ways to boost your confidence and let it shine. Dress comfortably. Regardless of what everyone else is wearing and what magazines say you should wear, dress in a way that makes you feel awesome. If ripped jeans, sneakers, and a sweatshirt make you feel beautiful and confident, then wear that outfit. Alternatively, if high heels and a miniskirt make you feel wonderful, wear that instead. It's all about how you feel in the clothes you wear. If you're uncomfortable in your clothes, you likely won't be confident, no matter how impressive the brands you're wearing. So try your outfit on, move around, and feel it out. If you're constantly pulling up your pants to hide your butt crack, you should probably change. It's also important to dress the part. If you're going out for a fun evening, make sure you're dressed in clothes that make you feel fun. If you're going to meet new business partners, dress in clothes that make you feel like a bawling CEO. The clothes don't need to be expensive. They just need to make you feel a certain way. Believe it or not, clothes can evoke certain emotions in us. I know this because I can't play my parent characters well without dressing up like them. I once read an interview with Jennifer Lawrence in which she too said she couldn't truly get into a character unless she was in costume. Power poses. Before you go into an event and or meet new people, look in the mirror for a few minutes and do some power poses. You should probably be alone for this or things could get weird. Look at yourself and pose like Superman or Superwoman with one arm in the air. Make a dramatic, sexy face like you see in movie posters. Raise your chin and give yourself a little wink. Fix your collar, even if it's completely fine. Why? Because you're powerful and sexy and you do what you want. Looking at yourself in the mirror and seeing yourself the way you want other people to see you is a great way to inspire confidence. Listen to your jams. Listen to music that makes you feel confident and powerful. For example, when getting ready to go out, I always listen to Rihanna because her music makes me feel awesome and sexy. This may seem like a minor thing, but listening to music that pumps you up will send signals to your brain and set a certain tone. A word of caution, though. I'd suggest staying away from Adele if you need to be happy and confident. Yeah, Adele has more of a getting ready to console a friend whose boyfriend cheated on her type vibe. Speak in statements. When you speak to people, make sure you're speaking at an audible volume. Speaking softly will make you seem less confident. Another tip, unless you're actually asking a question, don't sound uncertain. Start strong and end strong. Say things as if everyone really wants to hear them. Just make sure you give everyone else a chance to speak too. Body language. Body language can often speak louder than words. Crossing your arms or putting your hands in your pocket will make you seem unapproachable. If you aren't directly facing someone while they're talking to you, it will seem like you're not paying full attention. Slouching makes you seem less confident. Walking slowly can make you seem less certain. Whenever you do anything with your body, I want you to feel purposeful and powerful. Stand as if someone is creating a statue of you in that very moment. Walk as if there's an explosion happening behind you and you're an action movie star walking away. If you're not used to doing any of the above, it may sound like a lot of work. And you know what? At first it is. No one said having presence was easy. If that was the case, everyone would have it. But you're a boss, and you need to start acting, talking, and walking like one. The next time you walk into a room, just remember one thing. Be Santa. Why? Because he always has presence. Chapter 36. Say what you mean.
You're in a fight with your partner, and you're texting back and forth. You're sending paragraphs upon paragraphs, and you're fuming. You know exactly why you're mad, and you think your feelings are completely justified. You receive a response and start banging away at the keyboard with your own response. Before pressing send, you pause and think, wait, is this response okay? You run your response by your best friend just to make sure. Is this wording okay? What about this emoji? Is it too much or too little? I used to do this a lot. My camera roll was full of conversation screenshots until I learned one important lesson, and that is, say what you mean. If you say what you mean, you don't need someone to edit your words. Your feelings are authentic to you, and therefore don't need revision. There's great beauty in speaking in straight lines. I currently live in LA, and in my opinion, LA is the land of empty words. Now don't get me wrong, I love it here. I mean, there's palm trees and vegetarian food options for days. But I found that the social norm is to just say whatever sounds good. I'll have a 5-minute conversation with a stranger, and they'll end the conversation with, "Kay, love you." I can literally go out for dinner with someone once, and they'll text me a few days later saying, "Miss ya, how can you love me if you don't know me? And how can you miss me if you don't know what it's really like to spend time with me?" I get that "love you" and "miss you" sound friendly and polite, but what's polite about lying? The same idea applies when you run into someone you haven't seen in a while, and they end the conversation with, "Let's grab a coffee soon. I'll text you." We both know I'm never getting that text, but it sounds polite to say. However, it's actually not polite because it's not sincere. A boss doesn't make empty gestures. A boss says what they actually mean. A better response would be, "Hey, it was really nice seeing you. I hope I run into you again." That sounds just as polite, but it's not filled with fake fluff. Communication should be relatively easy, but we often make things complicated by not saying what we mean. We convince ourselves that we need to sugarcoat things to such a degree that our actual message ends up buried in sprinkles. Or we beat around the bush and people have to solve a puzzle to understand what we're saying. I believe you can be both charming and straightforward. I was at a party once, and across the room from me was an incredibly handsome man. I kept catching myself staring at him and thinking, "Oh my God, my girlfriends back in Toronto would absolutely die if they saw this beautiful man." Instead of stalking him the whole night or orchestrating a forced conversation with him, I approached him and told him exactly what was on my mind. Well, I mean, almost exactly what was on my mind. Meow. I said, "Hey, my name is Lily, and this is going to sound a little weird, but I have a girls' chat group with my friends back in Toronto, and I think they would find great joy in seeing a picture of you. You mind taking a picture with me so I can show them how incredibly hot you are? If you don't mind, that is." He laughed and happily agreed. Duh. I'm also a big believer in the phrase, say what you mean, but don't say it mean. Being straightforward doesn't mean you have to be rude or harsh. There's always a way to be open and honest while also being respectful. Anyone who behaves otherwise is just being lazy. This mentality is particularly helpful when you need to confront someone. Now, to be honest, I've never been any good when it comes to confrontation, but the more I focus on saying what I actually mean, the easier it gets. In the past, whenever I had issues with any of my employees, I used to rehearse what I would say, making sure to sound professional and stern. It would stress me out, and I would usually mess up during the actual conversation. But once I started just saying what I meant, communication became a lot more efficient. Here's an example of how I changed my communication style. The issue. My assistant keeps forgetting to do tasks. Before, I would say, "Hey, I need you to remember to do tasks because forgetting is unacceptable. I asked you to send 2 emails today and it didn't happen. Please ensure this doesn't happen again." But now I would say, "Hey, it's stressful for me when you forget to do tasks I've asked you to do. Constantly having to remind you defeats the purpose of having an assistant. I'd really like you to figure out a system that allows you to remember things." The before just sounds like office jargon. Literally, Siri could have said it. The after represents how I actually feel and exactly why the behavior is problematic for me. No matter what the situation is, it's always tempting to rehearse dialogue so that you say what you think you're supposed to say. And preparation and gathering your thoughts are awesome, but only if it results in meaningful and genuine communication. A boss doesn't just say things. They communicate with purpose. We're so used to communicating at a surface level that we often underestimate the power of communicating on a deeper, more human level. For example, I recently had to bail on one of my friends who asked me to grab lunch. I forgot about one of my deadlines and texted him the day before to cancel. I was bummed because I hadn't seen him in so long. This could have gone 2 ways. First, say whatever. "Hey, I'm so sorry I've got to cancel lunch tomorrow. I forgot I had a deadline. Can we reschedule? Thanks." Say what you mean.
Hey, I'm so sorry, but I've got to cancel lunch tomorrow. I forgot I had a deadline. I was looking forward to seeing you, and I'm disappointed I can't now. Please don't think this has anything to do with my desire to hang out with you, and I really hope we can reschedule. Saying what you mean makes life a lot easier to navigate. People will be impressed that you don't sound like a robot and actually have human emotions. Also, instead of forcing people to read between the lines, you can allow them to read the actual lines, which saves everyone a lot of time and energy. Communication shouldn't be a guessing game. It should be productive and straightforward. With that said, I don't want to just thank you for buying this audiobook. Rather, I want to genuinely tell you how grateful I am. I've worked really hard on recording this with the intent of making you laugh and inspiring you. Now, I don't know everything about success, but I'm confident about what I've said in these chapters. In fact, the fact that you're taking valuable time out of your day to listen to this book when you could be doing anything else is really special. Thanks for giving me a chance. Sincerely, not Siri. Chapter 37. Not Everyone Hates You. If things don't constantly go your way, it's probably because the world has weekly meetings discussing how to knock you down. It's true. It's like you're a plastic and we're all Lindsay Lohan. This is Mean Girls. You got cast without auditioning. Sorry to burst your bubble, but you aren't that special. Concluding that your failures and shortcomings are caused by other people and situations is a great way to give up all your power. It's also a great way to take the easy route in life and draw attention away from any real issues that need resolving. In my opinion, when people say things like, "Nothing ever works out for me," the real problem is that they're unwilling to change something or try a different tactic. Or when people say, "Everyone is against me," the real problem is that they aren't willing to see things from a different point of view. In reality, people are too busy worrying about themselves to devise some master plan to destroy you. When I was a student, my friends would all say the same thing to me. "Lily, you always need to be right." We all got along so well, but as soon as an argument started, they would drop that line and I would become instantly offended. I didn't need to be right. I was right. For years, I would think that everyone was just jealous of my superior correctness in life. My parents, friends, and fellow dancers were all wrong, and I was right. Not that I needed to be, though. I just was. It's not my fault I was blessed. I literally felt like that one presumably crazy person in a horror movie who hears voices and sees dead people. Everyone else in the movie thinks she's insane, and they send her to an asylum. They diagnose her with some mental disorder and then drive back home, only to be killed by 7 different ghosts. Oh, turns out she wasn't crazy after all. She was right all along. That was me, the absolutely correct victim in the asylum. Except I was wrong. As I grew older and began to hear, "Lily, you always need to be right," over and over again, I started to think, what if that's true? What if everyone else isn't wrong and I'm just too stubborn to take a look at myself and identify my flaws? It was definitely a lot easier to assume everyone was out to get me. Eventually, I made a promise to address my bad habit, and now when I have disagreements with people, I don't view the conversation in terms of right and wrong. Shifting my mentality took a lot of effort, and it didn't happen overnight. In fact, it took years to create my new mantra, which is, there is no right or wrong, there's just different. Repeating this to myself has helped me be less hung up on winning arguments. I only came to this realization because I stopped feeling sorry for myself and started paying attention to the signs the universe was giving me. Realizing that you have a weakness everyone but you can see is a tough pill to swallow. It's difficult to believe and it's even harder to fix. But a boss knows that accepting a weakness is the first step to strengthening that part of you. If your last 3 bosses all fired you, maybe it's not because they're jerks. Maybe you don't work hard enough. If your last 2 boyfriends cheated on you, maybe you're causing them to cheat. Maybe not, but maybe you are. I'm not saying a flaw within you validates their behavior, but I'm simply pointing out that it could be a reaction to something you're doing. Maybe you trust too much too fast. I went through a period when I felt like all my friends were liars. It seemed like every week I would find out someone lied to me about something. After the 4th friend lied to me, I had to step back and take a look at myself. I discovered that my friends were lying to me because they didn't feel like they could openly talk with me. Every time they tried, I create an unwelcoming environment, and they feared our friendship would end. Whether or not I believe that fear justifies lying is irrelevant. The fact remains that something within me was causing several people to act in the same way, and thus it made more sense to adjust my behavior. It's about working with what's in your control. Refer to chapter Play Nintendo. At the end of the day, we're all reactive beings. We react to the environment we're in. So if several people are reacting negatively to you in the exact same way, maybe it's because you're doing something to cause that reaction. If that's the case, you have two options. Number one, get a tattoo across your chest of Drake's lyrics, I got enemies, got a lot of enemies. Or number two, take the hint and work on improving yourself. I mean, your nipples would get in the way of a tattoo that big anyway. Chapter 38, Understand Priorities. On the surface, relationships seem to fail for so many reasons. It's easy to speculate endlessly. Is it because your girlfriend hates it when you go out with the boys to watch sports? Could it be because your boyfriend always skips class to flirt with other girls? Maybe your best friend travels too much and now you feel like you barely know her. We can blame the conflict on the fact that people are inconsiderate, disloyal, selfish, and weird. But once we dig our shovel further into the problems, it's clear that the majority of failed relationships are caused by one thing: having different priorities. Have you ever been in a fight with a partner or friend and thought, wow, how can you not understand that you're wrong? I'll just assume you're putting your hands up right now and saying, preach. That's because we have a specific set of priorities that we understand and value, and it's difficult to deal with someone who isn't on the same page. What we need to remember is that priorities are like opinions, because everyone has different ones. And, most importantly, priorities are not facts. Let me say it again so the people in the back can hear. Priorities are not facts. This means they cannot be right or wrong. They're simply different. What up, previous chapter reference? This lesson has been one of the hardest for me to learn in life. Once I learned it, though, it was like a light came on. Everyone has a different aha moment, but let me share mine. While I was on tour in Boston for a trip to Unicorn Island, preparing for my next show, I received word that the next day would be a little nerve-wracking for two reasons. First, we would be shooting the entire stage performance for my documentary, meaning the show had to be flawless. The documentary shoot was stressful because we only had one shot at capturing the footage. The entire crew was flying in with all their equipment, and the associated costs simply wouldn't allow for another chance at another performance in another city. As if this situation wasn't high stakes enough, Dwayne Johnson's family was coming to see me perform. For obvious reasons, their attendance was both exciting to me and extremely intimidating. I, of course, wanted to make the best impression on his family, especially his daughter, who introduced him to my videos in the first place. Needless to say, the night before, I was an absolute tense mess. I sat down with my entire cast and crew and thoroughly explained the importance of the next day's show. I emphasized that we needed maximum sleep so we could have maximum energy and perform our best. Stressed, shaking, and stuttering, I kept repeating just how much the show meant to me, like a broken record. Dear millennials, a record is an ancient musical medium, like a physical version of a download. Finally, I called everyone in for a team huddle and ended the meeting for the night since it was almost midnight. As I walked to my hotel room, I turned back briefly and saw, to my complete surprise, that a few of my dancers, two of whom were my oldest, closest friends, were not headed in the same direction. I could hear them discussing going out for a few drinks and food. Absolutely astonished, I walked up to them and exclaimed, "How are you going out right now after everything I just said?" They responded that they didn't think it was a big deal and they wanted to hang out for a bit. I was so furious, I just walked away. I didn't know what to say. Back in my hotel room, I replayed the incident in my head to see if I'd overreacted. But I felt extremely disrespected. I couldn't believe that my two friends, who were also my dancers, could betray me and disregard my feelings during such a stressful time. They were wrong, and nothing would convince me otherwise. The next day we did the show, and it went brilliantly. Everyone performed well, Dwayne's family loved the whole experience, and the crew captured amazing footage. To an outside observer, things would appear to be swell, but on the inside, I was still fuming. My friends had contributed to one of the most stressful nights of the tour for me. This fury lasted a few days until I finally just needed to talk to someone. I approached our tour manager, Dave, whom we had all taken to calling Dad, because truthfully, that's what he became to us. Dad always took care of us on the road and did everything to ensure we felt our best on and off stage. With my spirits low, I sat down beside him and said, "I don't get why my friends would do that to me before the most important show. They're so selfish." His reply was blunt but necessary. With kindness in his eyes, he replied, "Lily, just because something is important to you, it doesn't mean it's important to them." Have you ever heard something so simple yet profound that it literally felt like a switch had been flipped within you? That's what this felt like. Dad was absolutely right. All of my dancers, my friends included, performed so well every single night. They always put on a great show and never did anything offstage that negatively impacted their presence on stage. If my dancers had gone out that night and then danced horribly the next day, I would have the right to be upset. But they hadn't. The real reason I was upset was that I had mistakenly thought their personal priorities were identical to mine. A misguided assumption. Dwayne is my childhood hero, not theirs. The footage was from my documentary, not theirs. I was feeling stressed and anxious, and they weren't. They were paid to do a job, and they did it remarkably well. They were not being paid to care about what I cared about. Remember when I said nothing would convince me they weren't wrong? Well, Dad found a way. The same goes for professional relationships. If you start a business with a partner and your personal goals are to do a lot of charity and social work, you may run into issues if your coworker just wants to make a lot of money. Does wanting to make it big make him wrong? No. Some people want to be rich. Others want to make a social impact. Maybe both of your priorities will change and completely switch later in life, but for the moment, they're different. Now, that doesn't mean you can't be in a successful relationship with someone with different priorities. You can have the same goals even, but you need to learn to understand each other's priorities and keep them in mind. If you can be mindful of the fact that other people are motivated by their own priorities, you won't feel like they're intentionally disrespecting you. Your boyfriend going out to watch sports instead of hanging out with you for a night doesn't necessarily mean he's selfish. It means that he likes sports and that watching the game is a priority for him. If you absolutely cannot accept someone else's priorities, that's a good indication that maybe you're not the best fit for each other. After all, sometimes we base our expectations of people based on what we want them to prioritize. As with all expectations, you risk disappointment. But if you can learn to work with people in a way that doesn't make them feel like they have to sacrifice everything they care about, you'll go a long way. A boss knows how wonderful it feels when someone respects your priorities. I'll never forget the first time my mom placed importance on my content creation, after I'd spent years trying to get my parents to take my career seriously. My dad was asking me to go somewhere with him, and before I could reply, my mom told him, "She can't go today. It's Thursday, and she needs to make a video." I beamed with pride. It felt amazing to have my priority not only recognized, but accommodated, even if in a minor way, by someone I love. We all have a carrot dangling above our heads. For some people, that carrot is money. For others, it's family. And still for others, it's Instagram likes. The best relationships are those that not only allow you to have your own unique carrot, but also allow you to help your partner reach their carrot. If two people get to care about their priorities in addition to caring about each other, that's a win. So don't just assume everyone cares about what you care about. And more importantly, don't label that space between your priorities wrong or right. There's 7 billion people on the planet. We're all going to have different carrots. Bugs Bunny would have a field day. Maybe don't go into business with him. How you doing, listener? Let's try something fun. Let's prioritize. I want you to list your top 3 priorities in life. Be honest now, and remember, there's no right or wrong. After you're done that, I want you to list the priorities of someone else. Your girlfriend, boyfriend, mother, father, sister, anyone. Name 3. Chapter 39. Be unapologetically yourself. Everyone is weird. No matter how normal someone seems, I can assure you that they also do very weird stuff. When I make a speech, I wear high heels, a power suit, and eyeshadow. I stand up straight and use words like fathom and whom. I look put together, poised, and normal as F. Then I get backstage to my dressing room, put on my unicorn slippers, tie my hair like a horn on the front of my forehead, and gallop around while making pig noises. If someone asks me what I'm doing, I will respond only in the tone of a dramatic opera singer. That's the weirdo I am, and I'm proud of it! But there's more to being yourself than being weird. In this day and age, everyone thinks they're being their true selves because they use an abundance of Tumblr quotes indicating so and post double chin selfies. And I'm here to tell you that a silly selfie with 2 filters and a cute outfit with a caption that reads, "Sorry, not sorry," is a very basic level of being yourself. I've recently learned that true authenticity is like a beautiful lasagna with many layers. Once you get past the cute, cheesy stuff, it gets heavy. I used to live my life thinking I was completely myself. I embraced my weirdness, never pretended to be someone I wasn't, and stood up for what I believed in. If you told me I could be more myself, I would have sneered at you. Are you kidding me? I'm so me. If someone was taking attendance right now and called my name, I would raise both of my hands. But then I met someone, and within an hour, she changed everything I thought I knew about being authentic. I was introduced to a new level of realness, an unapologetic type, and it changed my life. It's October 2015, and I'm holding a jar of pickles and some flaming hot Cheetos, you know, as one should, as I nervously pace back and forth waiting to shoot a video. I'm anxious, excited, and terrified all at the same time. I'm a 27-year-old child. I approach my manager and start spitting out some inspirational sentences, mostly to reassure myself. Like, okay, this is going to be totally awesome. I'm just going to be cool. Look how chill I am. I look like the snowflake emoji just ate a chill pill in the Arctic. Mother effin' McFlurry vibes. Brrr. And then from the back of the room, I hear a voice excitedly ask, "Where's Lily?" All chill has left the building. Welcome to the Sahara Desert. Selena Gomez walks up to me with open arms and gives me a huge hug. Everything is fine. Look how chill I am. Just kidding. My body could literally be used as the set for Mad Max. We sit down, and for the next hour, Selena unintentionally schools me on authenticity. The first thing I notice is that Selena has already opened the Cheetos I gifted her and is happily enjoying them while slouched in her seat. She doesn't care that her makeup just got done. She wanted the Cheetos, and so she ate the Cheetos. Then there's me, trying to sit up straight, smile perfectly, and showcase the shirt I bought just for this occasion. What? This old thing? We start talking about her new album, Revival, and I make a creepy joke about her album cover, like, "Girl, look at you, all naked and hot on the cover. I see you." I'm expecting her response to be a giggle or smile alongside an obligatory thanks, but instead she calmly says, "It's so raw and beautiful." I can't remember a time when someone spoke to me with that level of self-awareness and confidence. She truly believed the cover was beautiful, and so she said it. I think so many of us don't own our own beauty because we fear sounding arrogant. But not Sel. She knows that calling yourself beautiful can be empowering, not necessarily cocky. During the shoot, I make a joke about people thinking my hair is fake. Selena puts her fingers through my hair and says, "You have beautiful, real hair. Mine, however, is very fake." No F's given. After the shoot, we take some selfies, and I make it a point to show them to Selena for approval. "Hey, Sel, are these okay? Also, can we be best friends forever by any chance?" Without hesitation, or even a second look, she responds, "Oh yeah, girl, they're fine." Selena is okay with however she looks in the picture, because that's how she looked at that moment. Now, you might be thinking that I'm completely biased because I'm a huge Selena Gomez supporter. And yeah, you're right. She's amazeballs. But I've had the pleasure of witnessing this unapologetic authenticity of hers time and time again. So let's fast forward to the second time I met her at We Day, which is an awesome event aimed at inspiring students in California. It's a brief meeting, but I'm still a little nervous, and this time I don't have any Cheetos as a peace offering. As soon as I see her, I say, "Hey, I don't know if you remember me, but..." And Sel cuts me off. I'm expecting her to say, "Yes, I do. Nice to see you again." Or, "Sorry, remind me your name again, please? I mean, that's what I've been hearing all day." But once again, I'm caught off guard as Selena laughs and lovingly says, "Oh my God, shut up, you idiot. Of course I remember you," as she pulls me in for a hug. In a day filled with protocol and cookie-cutter networking lingo, Selena's refreshing tone and vibe cut through the BS. She doesn't care about sounding any type of way. She speaks how she feels. Now let's move to the third time I met her. Yes, welcome to my book, The Chronicles of Fangirling Over Selena Gomez, Special Edition. Backstage at her concert in Toronto. By this time in my life, I'm a little more collected and don't completely freak out. As soon as I enter the room, Selena says, "Ugh, I'm so bloated, if you know what I mean." These are her first words. "I love this girl." Then we start talking about her tour, and it's at this moment that I officially declare Selena the most unapologetically real person I've ever met. We're talking about ticket sales, and she says, "It's been about 70% sold out at shows, which is a little bit less than last time." Now, I've been on tour before. Granted, my tour wasn't comparable in size to Selena's. I mean, I'm not an ex-wizard. But if you ever ask me about ticket sales, my deep, hidden insecurities would never allow me to openly say it was 70% sold out. I'd always felt I had something to prove. If my show didn't sell out, then there must be a reason. The venue, the tickets, the marketing. Someone somewhere is racist. And here's Sel, an A-lister, a pop star, not giving a fraction of an F about what people think about her ticket sales, telling it like it is. She is so accepting of every part of herself, whether it be her weakness, flaws, strengths, or accomplishments. If she feels beautiful, she embraces that feeling and admires herself. If she feels insecure about something, she doesn't shy away, but says it openly without hesitation. I've changed in the years since I've gotten to know her. I understand the difference between being yourself and being unapologetically yourself on a deeper level. Beyond the weird quirks and self-deprecating jokes I make in interviews, I'm learning to accept all facets of myself. If I'm upset and make a poor decision, I try not to be ashamed. I made that decision. My unique personality and life circumstances helped make that decision. And even if I have to fix whatever mess I caused, I own that decision. If I feel jealous or insecure, I embrace that side of me and proudly communicate it. That's my insecurity and jealousy, and it's who I am in that moment. With my newfound confidence to be undeniably myself, I decided to make a video called The Most Honest Q&A Ever for my YouTube channel. I'd like to direct your attention to two parts of this video. Number one, what would you do if you had $1 million? My old answer, I'm not really sure. Donate some, travel. I like to spend money on experiences. What I'm thinking, I want to come across as if money doesn't really matter because people will think I'm materialistic. New answer, well, I do have $1 million, and to be honest, it hasn't changed any major things I do. Money is the result of what I do, not the reason I do it. What I'm thinking, I'm proud that I've worked hard and earned money. I don't need to lie about it. I'm more proud that it hasn't changed me much. Number two, are you a virgin? Old answer, I think it's so interesting and strange that people ask this. What I'm thinking, let me curb this answer and avoid giving any real information because I'm embarrassed. New answer, yeah, I am. I used to be ashamed to admit that, but honestly, it's my decision. What I'm thinking, I'm proud of my decision, not because I think it's right, but because it's mine. My body, my life, my decision. There's no shame in my game. Answering those questions the way I did filled me with an entirely new and unique feeling of happiness. It's a beautiful thing to have complete self-acceptance. Nothing to prove, nothing to hide. You are who you are, and you should be damn proud, like a boss. Now, if you'll excuse me, someone just called for an Uber unicorn, wink, wink, and it's my time to shine. Hopefully it was Sal, because I'm craving Cheetos. Chapter 40, Shake What Your Mama Gave Ya. The first time I ever met Dwayne The Rock Johnson, I noticed something very specific about him. You might think I noticed how his right arm could pass as Godzilla stunt double. Or that he's so handsome that I wanted to legally change my name to Scissors so he just might smash me. Yes, I went there, and I'll go there again. Surprisingly, however, what I remember most vividly about meeting Dwayne wasn't his looks or giant muscles, although, I mean, those features were also great. What stood out to me was his behavior around people he just met, in this case, my film crew. He shakes every person's hand when he meets them. And when I say everyone, I mean everyone. From my sound guy, to my producer, to my assistant, and to the security guard who was trying to pry me off Dwayne's leg, which, by the way, stop that and let me live. Rock climbing has always been on my bucket list. I'm going to keep going there. For someone as rich and famous as Dwayne Johnson, I was shocked that he made a point to introduce himself to every new person he met, even if they didn't initiate the interaction. He acted as if people didn't know exactly who he was, which was both refreshing and impressive. Not only did my entire crew comment on his behavior after we were done shooting, but my friend and fellow YouTube creator Grace Helbig also pointed out this specific trait of Dwayne's after she met him for a shoot. If two girls get together to discuss Dwayne Johnson, and of all things end up talking about how he shakes people's hands, something is very wrong. Or perhaps very right. Since meeting Dwayne, I've met two other spectacular individuals who behave in a similar fashion. The king of soca music, Marshall Montano, walked into my dress rehearsal when I was performing in Trinidad and Tobago. The first thing he did was walk around the entire stadium and shake hands with all my dancers, my stage manager, the AV crew, and even some random people I didn't know who had probably snuck in. After rehearsal, all my dancers commented on how wonderful Marshall was. They met many new people that evening, but it was Marshall who blew them away. By the way, if you don't know what soca music is, you need to YouTube search some Marshall Montano right now. Your booty can thank me later. The other person whose impeccable manners and class have made a major impact on me is the star of The Tonight Show, Jimmy Fallon. He walked into my NYC dressing room the day I was scheduled to be on a show, and we instantly started chatting away about the show and my YouTube videos, until he looked around and abruptly stopped. Hi, how are you? I'm Jimmy, he said as he shook hands with my hair and makeup stylist. Hit by a wave of admiration, I thought, of course you're Jimmy. This is your show. You're a superstar. But superstardom didn't stop Jimmy from shaking